Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and I'm looking forward to tonight's show. It's just the three amigos tonight, and it's myself, Kyle Nelson, and Dr. Joe Holly. So we're going to be filling in. Sam's off doing some research on a new ventilator technology that she might be able to report back to us on in a future episode. And Becky and Dan are unavailable tonight, so it's just the three of us, and we'll get into some clinical topics tonight. But before we do that, we do want to touch on the extreme weather outlook and what happened in the past week and what we can look forward to in the coming week. And for that, we go to our meteorologist, Kyle. How you doing?
Jamie, I'm doing fantastic. Glad to be back on the podcast with all of you out there in Disaster Podcast land. Yes, as Jamie hinted at, over the past week, we have had a very exciting week of weather, both tropical and convective weather in the upper Midwest. So working our way to Wisconsin, Northern Illinois, and Michigan first, we had a classic fall hail and damaging wind event emerge where as the storms developed over Wisconsin, they grew tall very quickly with that afternoon heating. And some storms produced hail up to 4.5 inches in diameter near Appleton, Wisconsin. And as those storms moved eastward and they crossed the cooler waters of Lake Michigan, they started to decay and they started to become what we call downdraft dominated. And that's very typical of what we see in growing up in West Michigan, right? We see the storms come across the lake and sometimes they can keep their intensity, but this was one of those cases where once they crossed the lake, they started really producing those damaging wind gusts, widespread 40 to 70 mile an hour gusts, and over 100,000 customers without power. And to top it all off, the National Weather Service in Grand Rapids, Michigan, actually took a what they believe is a direct strike to their Doppler radar, which sits right out back of their office there. And forecasters on the floor were noticeably a little bit shaken, and it actually took the radar offline. So they're working to get that repaired as we speak. But turning our attention now to the tropics, Tropical Storm Mindy made a quick pass across northern Florida, bringing heavy rain and some gusty winds, 2 to 4 inches of rain, some isolated six inch amounts, and some wind gusts up to 50 miles an hour in spots is what I saw. So some scattered tree damage and things, but thankfully no known injuries or fatalities from that event.
And I'm just talking a little bit about the upper Midwest, and you're talking about the extreme wind gusts that they had coming off the lake. It's just another point that it's not just tornadoes or hurricanes and tropical cyclones that cause issues, but also there are opportunities for storms to create some significant straight line winds and that can cause some significant damage.
You're absolutely right, Jamie. And that is right. Tornadoes, they're the sexy weather hazard. That's what gets a lot of the TV time, the airtime, the news articles and things like that, the attention on social and digital media spaces. But truly, it is the straight line winds and those higher wind gusts with some of those storms that were being produced that truly did cause the majority of the damage, including some structural damage due to falling trees as well. So my thoughts are definitely with my friends and colleagues there back in western and central Michigan as they are going through cleanup and recovery operations.
And I know I just did a gander at hurricanes.gov before we started recording, and I noticed that there are some potential. Larry's still churning away in the mid-Atlantic. We've got a couple of other areas of interest that one in the Caribbean and one off the coast of Africa, but nothing that seems to be looming in particular risk to the mainland of the United States, correct?
Right you are, my friend, at least in the short-term outlook. We'll see. It looks like we've got an active pattern of disturbances or tropical waves coming off of the African coast. And as they travel westward, of course, our friends at the National Hurricane Center, those experts will keep an eye on them. But in the eastern Pacific, just to mention, because this is getting a little bit of attention now, Hurricane Olaf impacting the very southern portion of Baja California Sur, this evening as we're recording, as well as tomorrow, Friday, heavy rain, flash flooding, and mudslides being the primary threats there. At the moment, the Central Pacific doesn't have anything on the scope.
Excellent. Well, Kyle, thanks for keeping us up to date, as always, on the weather front. And now hopefully you can put on your medical hat, and we'll switch over with Dr. Joe and talk a little bit about a few clinical topics. Joe, first off, how you been? I know you've been busy with a lot going on lately.
Have indeed. Hello, everybody. And Kyle, great to have you back on the podcast, man. We've missed you.
Always good to be here, Joe. I'm excited for some clinical topics tonight.
Yeah, so we were going to chat a little bit about CRUSH syndrome based on some questions that came up recently, but I think we also wanted to hit on a little bit of everybody's favorite topic, COVID.
Yeah, it's something that I think we just need to touch on. It's basically because here in the U.S., kids are returning to school this time of year. And I know particular interest and concern to a lot of people is, originally it was felt that younger people, especially children, weren't as at risk for COVID. And yet we do see numbers of infections among young people rising and numbers of hospitalizations rising. And I wanted to see, is anything changed about the effects of COVID on children, or is this just a function of increased infection rates in communities?
I think it's mostly the latter. We've got about half the general public vaccinated, and especially higher rates than that in the more vulnerable parts of our population, elderly and immunocompromised folks and that sort of stuff. And I think the Delta variant is clearly much more infectious than prior versions of this virus. And that has led to seeing younger and younger folks be the rapidly growing numbers of new infections. And I think, I think it's important to put that in perspective. The less than 17 age group, at least in my area of the country, is currently the fastest growing group of new infections. But at the same time, those numbers are smaller. And so it's important to understand they're growing fast, but, they still haven't overtaken the sheer numbers of older folks in the population that are part of that. And I think a lot of that has to do with kids back in school. A much more transmissible version of the virus now that we've seen before, and immunization of our vulnerable populations. But clearly there's still some exposure in the unvaccinated population, who currently makes up the vast majority of hospitalizations, intensive care unit admissions, and patients on ventilators with COVID.
Well, it's good to know that, the children are, while there's a faster growing group, basically because of returning to school, but they're still not as likely to have a severe effect as adults, which is good news for the young folks out there and the parents out there. Kyle, any questions on COVID before we move on to CRUSH syndrome?
No questions from me on the COVID front.
Well, then we'll move right along and jump in. Now, Joe, you said you have some questions about CRUSH syndrome. Before we jump into the specific questions, why don't we do a quick review of exactly what CRUSH syndrome is?
Sure, happy to do so. And before we do so, let me point out one other thing related to COVID that I think is important for folks to understand. And that is we continue to learn about the long-term impacts of COVID. And it definitely seems clear that this virus has significant capability to generate long-term damage, whether that's to lungs or kidneys or many other tissues the cardio. I was going to say cardiomyopathy. That's not the right word. The endocarditis that we're seeing in kids is certainly an example of that. So I think the point I wanted to make here is that we do not yet clearly understand the long-term consequences of being infected with COVID. And I'm not certain that I want to be one of the test subjects for that. So please go get vaccinated. And as soon as we have more information on kids, let's get kids vaccinated. In the meantime, let's protect kids by having all those around them be vaccinated. So I just really worry about some long-term health issues that have yet to be well understood coming out of COVID.
And you know, I think the vast majority of people that are hospitalized and those that are dying right now, I think a lot of people would say are largely preventable. If we could just get people vaccinated, we could stave off a lot of what's going on out there right now.
I think that's very true, and frustrating and sad and et cetera.
So crush syndrome, Joe, what is it and how do we manage it?
Yeah, so this topic came up based on a few of the USAR teams that have been out in the last few weeks related to hurricane response, both in the southeastern United States, Louisiana, et cetera, but also in the northeastern part of the U.S. that took a much more substantial hit from hurricane damage than I think we've seen in the past. And so the concept behind crush syndrome in general is the idea that a crushing injury, be that from fallen debris or a collapsed structure, that crushes tissue, particularly muscle tissue, enough to cause it to become ischemic. In other words, it's not able to be adequately perfused, begins to die over a period of time. And the pressure of the entrapment frequently keeps many of the bad things that are happening in the ischemic extremity, for example, sort of isolated from the rest of the body until we release that pressure that's on that entrapped part. And then that those toxic metabolites, et cetera, flow back into the main circulation and frequently result in death. And the main things that we worry about there is as you crush muscle tissue and it becomes ischemic and ultimately dies, and then the muscle cells begin to rupture, all the stuff that's inside those muscle cells leaks out into the circulation. And the things that we worry about there are myoglobin, which is the big muscle protein, and potassium, which is inside cells in higher concentrations and is necessary for nerve conduction and muscle activity, et cetera. And the other thing that's happening in that during that same time is that those ischemic tissues are utilizing very inefficient biochemical processes to try to stay alive and manufacture ATP and all the other stuff, all the other biochemical processes that are going on. And because those are very inefficient pathways that are being done without oxygen, they result in an excessive amount of lactic acid building up in the bloodstream, many other acids as well, but that's the primary one. So as the load is taken off of the entrapped part, and that area is now reperfused, you pump fresh blood in there, and all the blood that's been sitting around in that space now surges back into the core circulation, that blood that's flowing out of the formerly entrapped area has very high concentrations of acid, very high concentrations of potassium, and lots of the myoglobin molecules. And what happens is that onslaught of fairly toxic chemicals results in potassium levels going up very quickly. That affects the heart and its ability to beat correctly. The acid that's flowing into the bloodstream makes the heart particularly much more sensitive to abnormal levels of potassium, so that just exacerbates that problem. And then the myoglobin molecule floats around in the circulation until it gets to the kidney, and then at acid conditions cannot be excreted from the kidney very effectively. So the things that frequently happens is once the tissue is reperfused, the crush is released, all those toxins flow into the central circulation. And a few minutes later, the patient begins to become very sick and frequently dies in those situations. So our goals around the treatment of crush are to be prepared for those biochemical disasters to happen and to treat patients ahead of time. And this is really where the questions came from some folks in the field that were concerned about this and trying to better understand sort of how far ahead of time do we need to treat people and how much do we need to treat them ahead of time and all of that. And as with most things in medicine, it depends. Really, there's no simple, straightforward answer here. My response to them was that if you are evaluating a patient who has a large area of tissue, an entire leg, for example, that has been crushed pretty substantially and has been isolated from the rest of the bloodstream, then I would prepare very aggressively ahead of time for the large dump of potassium and acid and myoglobin that's about to flow out of that extremity as soon as the pressure is released. And that I would start that far enough ahead of time to be able to ensure that I could handle that onslaught. That might be 30 minutes, that might be an hour, depending on how fast things are moving. And that my aggressiveness toward therapy would be based on patient response. So we can utilize a peaked T wave on the EKG in the field as a great indicator of potassium levels. And if I saw the T wave beginning to get tall and peaked, then I would be much more aggressive in my treatment to combat the high potassium levels. We can certainly look at urine output and the dark sort of Coca-Cola colored urine that we often see with myoglobin that's beginning to appear in the urine. And so the shorter answer really is just related to tempering your aggressiveness of therapy to the situation that you're seeing from the patient. And you obviously need to get a little bit ahead of that and try to stay ahead of that, but that we do have some tools that we can use in the field to help modify how aggressive we need to be and how quickly we need to initiate therapies. So that's a long answer to your question, but I hope sort of covers the issues that came up in the field the other day.
No, I think it's a great overview and looking at what can be done. I get the sense that this is a relatively rare occurrence, so it's not something that you get a chance to treat all that often.
I think that's very true. You know, it's fairly unusual to have to treat a patient that has some body part that is not only entrapped, but ischemic at the same time, meaning, you know, crushed. And I think it, people don't tend to think about it very much, but I think if you really think about the pathophysiology of crush syndrome and you look at the things that are happening, I think that we actually see this disease a lot more frequently than we think we do. And the classic example of seeing it much more frequently is the elderly patient who fractures their hip, falls on the hardwood floor in the bathroom, and can't move for a number of hours. And those patients are experiencing a very mild and generally pretty well compensated form of crush syndrome. The tissue that they are lying on, their own body weight is enough to cause ischemia. That's how we get pressure sores and everything else related to that. So we get some crush syndrome there initially. In general, it obviously occurs over a much longer period of time, and therefore the body has more time to compensate for it. So we don't tend to see severe acidosis and significantly high potassium levels. But in general, if you look at the patient that's just been lying on a hard floor for a number of hours, their potassium levels will tend to be elevated a bit. Their bicarb levels may be a little bit low, as they might be a little bit acidotic. They may well have a small amount of myoglobin in their urine. Again, none of which are reaching levels of real criticality, but are the earliest signs of crush syndrome. And crush in reality is just that process on steroids, no pun intended, where a much larger amount of tissue is involved, a much larger amount of ischemia is involved, and the time it takes to develop life-threatening crush syndrome certainly can vary a huge amount. You know, the more tissue that's involved and the more ischemia that's involved, the shorter period of time it takes. So a little pressure for a long time or a lot of pressure for a short time.
I'm curious if it ever makes sense to maybe if you got an isolated extremity that's been crushed for a period of time, would it make sense to apply a tourniquet in a way that allows you, that buys you some time to get them to a hospital setting where you have a little more control over what you can administer, how you can test for lab levels and things like that? Or is this something that is best treated immediately in the field?
Well, I think it's a great question. The short answer is it makes a lot of sense, but we don't have any real great data to direct us one way or another. I think the thinking around crush syndrome many years ago is that we wanted to try to avoid the use of tourniquets because we already had a significant amount of ischemia there and we were just going to make that worse. But I think now it probably does make sense to consider the use of a tourniquet, particularly if you have an isolated extremity, and particularly a proximal extremity where the muscle amount of muscle is much greater than, you know, it's hard to develop crush syndrome from a foot crush. There's just not enough muscle there to really make much difference. But as you work your way up the leg or up the arm, obviously things get much more substantial. So I would definitely consider the idea of placing a tourniquet there prior to extrication, and then sort of using that tourniquet to adjust the flow to some extent, trying to reperfuse that extremity as much as I could. But if I saw tremendous changes in T waves, et cetera, that we talked about earlier, I might consider, you know, tightening that tourniquet back up and giving myself a few minutes to kind of catch up and make certain I've got that under control before I loosen the tourniquet again.
What are the primary drugs we might consider using to manage crush syndrome in the field?
So one of the primary drugs that we use is bicarbonate. We do that to try to correct the acidosis so that we reduce the sensitivity to potassium. Bicarb also has a tremendous value in altering the pH of urine. And if we're able to alter the pH of urine just a little bit from 7.40 to 7.55 or so, we can greatly enhance the excretion of the myoglobin molecules. So we reduce the chance of renal failure, et cetera, and we help to get the myoglobin out of the system. The remainder of our therapies are really based on restoration of circulating volume. So we need enough fluid on board to make certain that the circulatory system is functioning normally. And the remainder of the drugs are really about combating high potassium levels. So we do that by trying to drive potassium back inside the cell so that it doesn't cause all the havoc that it does when it's not inside the cell. We can do that with insulin and sugar, D50 or D25. We can counteract the effects of potassium on many of the muscle and nerve tissues by administering calcium, which helps to kind of block potassium channels a little bit. We can utilize a drug like albuterol, which a lot of the beta agonist drugs have a nice side effect of being able to drive potassium back into the cell. And so that short term can help us as well. And then if we need to eliminate potassium from the body in general, there are a number of drugs that help us diurese the body and that sort of stuff to get rid of excess potassium loads. But those are sort of down the road a little way, if you will.
Kyle, we've kind of been talking without bringing you into the conversation. Do you have any questions about crush syndrome or management of these patients?
No, not specifically with crush syndrome, but Dr. Joe, I know another thing that can sometimes rear its ugly head when it comes to crush injuries are things, something called compartment syndrome. Can you talk about the difference between crush and compartment syndrome? And, you know, can they be found in the same patient? And if so, does that change your treatment at all?
Well, great question, Kyle. So compartment syndrome is basically crush syndrome that is limited to a single compartment in the body. And by compartment, we usually mean the compartments in, for example, the leg that contain mostly muscle tissue. So if you think of the muscles in the leg, they are surrounded by very heavy fascial tissues and bone and things like that that don't tend to stretch very well. And so if a significant injury occurs to the muscle that's inside that compartment that can't stretch, as that muscle swells inside a locked box, the pressure goes up so much that the muscle becomes ischemic. And so you see all the same things with compartment syndrome that you do with crush syndrome. It's just that with compartment syndrome, it tends to be localized to the muscle within that compartment and doesn't tend to leak out into the general circulation and wreak the more widespread havoc that we see in crush syndrome.
That's a great question, though, Kyle. I think it's fantastic. Do you have a follow-up?
You know, I was kind of thinking that it just with the pathophysiology of all this, I know that there'd be a lot going on in this particular case, but I remember when I was doing some training at the Center for Domestic Preparedness, talking with some firefighters from New York City, they had talked about what they call space cases. That is, individuals who can sometimes become trapped in between a subway car of a train and the platform, and the name comes from that there, you know, the extreme pressure that's being applied to the patient's body, whether it be the torso or other parts, and that, you know, as soon as they, you know, release that pressure, that it's there's a very good chance that that patient may experience a negative outcome. And I was just trying to think, with all this discussion, it might that be in some way related to crush syndrome and the acidity and the potassium and all that that develops in the extremity that's isolated from the heart?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Kyle. You know, we see syndromes kind of similar to this related to the scenarios that you just described. We also see it in folks who are in a harness of some sort. For example, an electrical utility worker who's up a pole and who's harnessed and then gets shocked and knocked unconscious and is hanging in this harness for a number of hours. And effectively, what's happening there is a tourniquet effect around the body, wherever the harness is around the body, or wherever the body's trapped. So, you know, everything that is on the other side of the tourniquet is becoming ischemic, and all the bad stuff is happening that we were talking about earlier. And, you know, I think that as we extricate people from all of those different circumstances, we need to be prepared for not only all the metabolic stuff we were just talking about, but think about the patient you described, for example, that's trapped between a platform and a subway car, you know, around the waist or torso. You know, all that tissue that is distal to that tourniquet effect is doing all the stuff we were talking about earlier, but also realize all the vasculature, as it becomes ischemic, it becomes very leaky. The capillary membranes begin to fail and tissue leaks out and they become very swollen and all that sort of stuff. And so when they get freed from that situation and reperfused, a lot of that tissue, a lot of that fluid that flows into that ischemic tissue now just leaks out into the interstitial spaces and doesn't actually provide a lot of perfusion, but provides an awful lot of swelling. But those patients can very quickly become hypotensive from lack of adequate circulating volume, because it's all leaked out of the pipes into all the tissue that's surrounding the pipes, because the pipes are now very leaky.
That's
interesting, Joe. It's so neat to see so many parallels and things. So just shout out to our friends that have to work in those situations. And I think about this too, and with the suspension trauma that you mentioned, because for me, you know, on ski patrol and also in my work doing radios and communications, right, I'm in a full body harness climbing towers or zipping along chairlift cables and climbing on gondola cabins and things. And so that is one of the things that we definitely do focus on, right, is the speed with which you have to self-rescue if you're, you know, you take a fall onto your safeties, right? You're hanging from your, we would call it like our dorsal ring, right? That D-ring in the center of your upper back. And you know, if you're still able and have your wits about you, we practice what we call self-rescue, right? Correcting yourself, getting back on your chest ring so that, right, taking that pressure off of those leg loops and those leg straps and things for sure. And then also the buddy rescue component. So if your partner should go unconscious, right, how do you access them and then get them down safely and do that in a timely manner? So definitely really, really interesting parallels between a lot of the work that we do outside of the show here as well.
You know, Joe, it's interesting to think about all the different ways this can happen. And I think the thing that it comes down to from what I hear you saying, is that you need to have a plan.
I think that's exactly right. You know, the first issue is awareness of what may be coming your way and what may be coming the patient's way, and then a plan to respond to that. You know, as I look at the disaster response world and I think about an entrapped patient that we as rescue folks, responders, et cetera, have spent many hours at great personal risk and lots of time and equipment on to try to rescue those folks, and to subsequently have a bad outcome because we were not paying attention enough, aware enough, or aggressive enough in our therapy, puts all of that risk to waste. You know, to have a bad outcome after an incident like that, it frustrates me intensely because we've spent huge amounts of time, energy, and risk of a number of people to get those folks out, and then we have a bad outcome. And sometimes that happens anyway, but I certainly don't want to downplay the amount of risk that's often encumbered by those that are trying to do the rescue. And, you know, you pull that patient out and 30 minutes later, they go into cardiac arrest because their pH is low and their potassium is high. And, you know, nobody's aware of what's going on. And it's kind of like, well, why did we spend all that time rescuing that guy? We accomplished nothing here. So it's, you know, it's just it's a return on the investment to some extent to make certain that we think about these things in the appropriate situations and that we are aggressively looking for and treating this condition so that we can avoid the bad outcome that may come, and that the risk that we go to try to perform one of those rescues is not in futility.
I can hear that, and I have a final question for you, Joe, and it is there a time frame to be aware of where, you know, is it a half hour, is it an hour of entrapment? What are we thinking about here? Is there anything that we can have in the back of our mind to start thinking about this as an issue, or is this something we should just always maintain suspicion about?
Well, I think you were sort of back to the original question that started this whole conversation, and that is, you know, what's the right time and when should you get started on trying to do this? So I think you have to think about this in terms of the situation that the patient is in. If my entire leg is crushed by a very heavy weight, a car or a building, and, you know, it's not going to take more than 15 or 20 minutes for that tissue to become ischemic any more than it's going to be ischemic if I put a tourniquet on my leg, right? So it's all related to the intensity of the crush, the amount of tissue that's involved, the length of time that the victim has been there. And thinking of it in terms of how likely is there to be a significant amount of ischemic tissue that is currently isolated from the rest of the circulation. And if you sort of think of it with that approach, then the situation will help to declare this is a pretty high likelihood that we're going to have some of that, and I need to be getting prepared before we finish our extrication here. And I certainly need to be prepared as soon as that extrication frees the patient, because that's when I'm likely to see changes that occur over just the next few minutes. So I need to be prepared for that. So it's thinking about it under the right circumstances and then adjusting your aggressiveness based on the amount of that you think might be present.
And I imagine a certain level of coordination between the mechanical rescue and the medical rescue team to make sure that we don't release that pressure prior to having interventions ready to go.
You're 100% correct, and that is definitely part of the process, where we've got to make certain that we're all on the same field and we're all following the same rules.
Well, that's it for me, Kyle. I know I think I stole your question based on your answer in the chat, but is there anything else you want to bring up as a final thought or comment or question before we wrap up?
Not for me, Jamie. No questions, thoughts, or comments.
Great. Well, Joe, you know, I think this has been a great clinical topic. It's also a great example of the amazing amount of knowledge and information that comes from you and all the people you work with at Paragon Medical Education Group, because you guys talk about topics like this all the time when you're dealing with teaching disaster response rescue techniques and things like that in the various areas that you do the education process. Where can folks find out more about how they can learn more about what you guys can do, talking about things like crush syndrome and other rescue techniques?
Well, we certainly like to talk to folks about customizing an educational experience to suit their needs. So we would ask that they reach out to us at paragonmedicalgroup.com or on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group. And they can always reach us through the Disaster Podcast or the Disaster Podcast Facebook page.
Excellent. Kyle, where can folks find you if they want to see what you're up to lately?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the major social media platforms under the handle WXKyleNelson and on my website, WXKyleNelson.com. I'd love to connect with our listeners to continue the conversation.
Excellent. And folks can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations. So please look me up and follow me there. Also, we want to thank Sam for getting out there and doing some investigation on some things for us. And hopefully we'll get a report from her in a future episode. We'll actually be off next week as we're doing some vacationing. But we will be back the last week of September, and I'll bring an episode for you then for sure. In the meantime, I want to thank everybody for checking out this episode of the Disaster Podcast. As always, you can find us at disasterpodcast.com and over in our Facebook group at the just search for Disaster Podcast in Facebook and you'll find it. Join the group, join the fun, join the community over there, and we'll continue this discussion there. And in the meantime, you know, keep your eyes open, be aware of what's going on with yourself, your patients, the rescue situation, and maybe you'll be able to recognize crush syndrome when it presents.